Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Next month will mark 21 years since journalist Martin O'Hagan was murdered in the street in Lurgan. 21 years and his killers still roam the streets, and his family have been picking up the pieces and fighting for justice ever since. Today's guest is Martin O'Hagan's brother Fintan, who is carrying that torch for justice and truth. Welcome on today's podcast, Fintan.
Thank you, Patricia.
21 years next month since you lost your big brother.
Mm-hmm.
What's those 21 years been like?
Up and down. You know, you're given hope and then it's snatched away. And, you know, in my experience, at the start, everybody was assuring us, we know who it is, we're going to get them. Everybody being the police. And so as I've said numerous times, that, you know, your expectations is here, and they just gradually bring them down. In the first investigation, we met with detectives and myself, my brothers, and they assured us that there was going to be arrests, there was going to be, we said, well, if there's any police involvement, we'll arrest them. And they were gung-ho and they were going to get them, and they knew who'd done it. Everybody knew who'd done it. And then at the time, about a month later, 6 weeks, they did arrest them. They went to arrest them. The right people, the culprits who actually done it. But the main guy had fled, which, you know, to any right-thinking person, that's an admission of guilt. Why else would you run away? So he ran away, and then a couple of months later, he presented himself at Lisburn police station. It was just changing from the RUC to the PSNI. And he presented, well, it was just changing when Martin was murdered. And he presented himself to the police station. They brought him in, apparently gave him a wee cup of tea, him and his solicitor. Then they brought them to, it was either Banbridge or Lurgan, and let him go.
That was 4 hours, wasn't it? He was questioned for 4 hours.
We don't even know if he was questioned. But they let him go. And this was the guy who planned it, and this guy drove the car. And while the other guy shot him. Shot Martin. And as I say, he run away. So admission of guilt, run away. And then it goes with solicitor, the thing. And they hold him for 4 hours, give him a wee cup of tea, bring him for a wee spin up the Lurgan or Banbridge and let him go.
For anyone who doesn't know, who has listened to this, Martin was murdered by the Loyalist Volunteer Force.
Yep.
And he is the first journalist to have been targeted and killed for his work during the Troubles. Do you believe it was Martin's work that led to him being murdered, his exposés of collusion, of paramilitaries, of their activities, and in particular, the Loyalist Volunteer Force?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, he was rotting cages. He, you know, he had been he received death threats from Billy Wright, and it was Billy Wright's crew. After Billy Wright was killed himself, it was his crew that murdered Martin. It was part of his gang, and you know, the really galling, hurtful thing is Martin made it easy for them because he moved in beside them. And to this day, myself and my brothers are incredulous about that there, but can't go back.
And when you say he moved in beside them, he was living on the fringes of a loyalist estate in Lurgan,
yeah,
which kind of, you know, put more of a target on his back in a sense.
Made it easy for him. And he drank in the same pub every week. And he had a routine. He was a creature of habit, him and his Mrs. Maury, God rest her. They drank in Father Joe's pub, and they walked home. They lived, say, maybe 10 minutes walk from it, and downed at home, a few drinks in them. And they'd done the same thing every week. And these people just, actually, the week before it happened, one of the gang, you know, a prominent member of the LVF gang, shouted, "We're clocking you, O'Hagan."
Shouted it to him.
Shouted it at Martin. "We're clocking you, O'Hagan," and the next week they murdered him.
They murdered him.
And shot him in the back.
Fenton, take me back to the night that Martin was killed in the street. When did you first hear that your brother had been shot?
At the time, I was living in town, and I was living next door to a pub, and the railway bar, and myself and my wife and were watching TV. It was about 11 o'clock, and it was banging on the door. And the guy who owned the pub, excuse me, he was banging on the door, and I went out, and he says, "Have you heard anything?" And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, I've heard Martin's was shot." And I said, "Is he dead?" And Noel said, "I don't know," and put his head down. And I knew then. And fair play to him, he says, "Will I bring you up?" And I says, "No, I'll get in touch with my brothers." So I got in touch with my three other brothers, and we drove around, got them up, drove up to the murder scene, and Martin was still on the road, and his wife was just hysterics, as you know, as you would be, and it was just awful. You know, you hear, you know, right down through the troubles, you hear about this one was, you know, people's been murdered, and it's all murder, you know. Mm-hmm. People's been, you know, should it be a cop? Should it be a Brit? Should it be, it's all murder. And their mommies all feel the same. But when you hear somebody, you say, "Oh God, that's awful." But you don't realise how awful it is until, you know, it comes to your door. And, you know, I thought my heart, you heard people saying, you know, the heart broke. I thought my heart was going to break. And it's awful, and it was awful for me as his wee bra, but it's 10 times worse for his wife, 100 times, 10 times, 100 times worse for his wife and his three daughters. You know, it's just, and yeah, it just decimates a family. It just wrecks everything. And you know, people hear about the murder, but they don't. It's the ripple effect. And like my ma, My ma and Martin's wife, Maury, share the same name. My ma was dead 3 years later. Broke her wee heart. Couldn't get over it. Just broke her wee heart. And my dad died a year after that.
So within 3 years of Martin's murder, both your parents had passed away.
And it did kill them. It did. My ma died of a broken heart. You know, They didn't just murder Aaron Morton. They murdered my ma and helped my dad. It helped my dad to die too. They just couldn't get over it. They just couldn't handle it. Like, my ma was in her 70s, my dad was in his 70s, and, you know, you're not supposed to lose your son like that, or your eldest son. And Morton's wife, Maury's, God rest her, she's dead now too. 20 years later, you know, she wrecked her too.
Just never got over it. And it doesn't help then, Fintan, that you and your family have to continue on and push for justice, something that should have been given to you.
Well, the fact that everybody knew who it was, you know, and Morton moved up there on the outskirts of Morangie, and do you see 99.9% of the people in Morangie are just the same as the people down here? You know, we all have to go to work, we all have to pay our bills. We're all the same type of people, and 99% of them people are good, decent people. And the embarrassment they felt that it was done on their patch, and the many people who stopped me in the street, people from Morangie, people I knew from years ago, you know, stopped me in tears and apologising to me, and I'm saying, listen, it's not your fault.
It affected the whole area, the whole community.
It did. You know, like, Aaron Morton was a controversial fella, but the people who approached me, come to my brother's doors, brought mask cards, you know, people who Morton might have had a falling out with, might have been rubbed up the wrong way, antagonized by one of his stories. Everybody just set that aside and were just, this is wrong. This is, you know, walking home with your wife after a few pints in the pub, and, you know, these people shoot you in the back because they would have perceived Morton as a Catholic. Morton had no religion, no time for religion. And he was an easy target. And, you know, people who lived in that area, in the Morangie area, actually told me who done it. And, of course, I told it to the police. Police said, well, we know we're going to get them. 21 years later, you know. Mm-hmm. And they know every, you know. But our problem is now, we know that the police know all the details and all the facts, but our worry is now, did they know beforehand? Because we're pretty sure that intelligence knew beforehand. The fact that there's 53 or 56,000 hours of recording, voice recording, filming on the LVF in this area. 56,000 hours. So how could that's one reason.
And is that over a certain time period?
That's over a certain time period,
after Martin's murder.
Before. And not just on the gang that did it. Well, they're all in one gang, but from Lurgan Pody down, an intelligence investigation in them recorded 56,000 hours. I didn't make it up. That came from the police. And so how could the, you know, that's one reason.
So that's why you would believe that they could have known beforehand that Martin was going to be targeted by the LVF?
Yeah, and not only that, but about 3 years ago, this guy came into my place of work, and actually before years this August, and this guy came in shaking like a leaf. I knew there was something up, can I talk to you? I brought him somewhere private, and he told me, he didn't tell me his right name, but he told me who he was, gave me an idea. He was an ex-soldier. He showed me his pension book, and you know, he's been looked into by our solicitors, KRW Law, and he was an ex-soldier. And he told me that he came from a loyalist background in East Belfast, and indeed his own dad was murdered, and his half brother was murdered by the provost. So he told me that he had joined the army. The army actually come to his school and recruited him when he was 16, which was strange. And him and a couple of other guys. And he was out in patrol and doing stuff, and he was in Lurgan. And so the army intelligence approached him. Listen, we want you to work for us. But this time he was about 18, 19. So he said, no problem. So they embedded them in the LVF, Lurgan Portage Iron. And he was there in a conversation when they were planning to murder Martin. So he went to his handler, his intelligence handler, who was a captain in the army, and he went to him and he said, right, they're going to murder Martin O'Hagan, the journalist. And his captain asked him all the details, obviously, the captain says, right, leave it with me. So he took that as, you know, he nailed them. They're going to, he had supplied all the details, well, everything he knew. And this guy actually told us that he went to the arms dump, collected the weapon, and gave the killers the weapon. Yeah? Now, this guy, this all didn't come out in the first meeting, because when he came to my place of work, first thing I did was ring my solicitor, Kevin Winters, and KRW Law, and Niall Murphy, and they said, can you get him in? And the guy agreed to come in the next day. So this was a Thursday. The next day, we were sitting in Kevin Winters' office in Belfast. That afternoon, Kevin Winters had approached the ombudsman, approached the police. He'd got everything done, statements and all sorted. So this guy said he went to the arms dump, lifted the weapon, supplied the weapon to the murderers, told his handler, his intelligence handler, that Martin was going to be murdered. His intelligence handler says, leave it with us, we'll sort that out. Right? Next week, or the next Friday, they murdered Martin.
The very next Friday,
they murdered him. And so the ex-soldier, he went to his handler. What the F's going on here? I told you they were going to kill that man, and you let him die. And the handler says, what do you care? He's an ex-Republican prisoner. What do you care? And so I'm not a policeman. I can't verify this guy's telling the truth. But we've told the police, we've told the ombudsman. Police haven't, are yet, this is near 4 years, they are yet to interview that fella. And we met with the police, with the legacy department, and in Kevin Winters' office, and we told them everything. Held that back, told them everything. Right, so away he went, says he's going to investigate it, and away he went. He come back a few months later, meeting again in KRW's office in Belfast. this guy's no good. What do you mean he's no good?
This is the man who came to you with this information, the Army intelligence officer.
The soldier who was working for Army intelligence. So we says, right, well, explain. Can't. What do you mean you can't? You can't just tell us he's no good and let it go at that. Sorry, the expression they use, it's a security matter. We says, no, hold on a wee second. Prove to us that he's no good. We can't. But you can't just, this guy's saying he supplied the weapon. This guy's telling us details that nobody else could know. And you're just going to tell us that it's no good and we're supposed to accept that. And they still haven't interviewed him.
And they still haven't give you a good enough reason as to why
they haven't explained this. They just, sorry, we can't. Security reasons.
So this individual was good enough to work as an intelligence officer for the army, but he's not good enough to be a witness in the murder.
You'd think that they would interview him and clear it up. And if he is no good, that's okay. But then, you know, explain this why he knows so much. Explain this. He's admitting to having supplied the weapon. That's conspiracy to murder. Why have you not talked to him about that? Yeah, it's absolutely nuts. And, you know, we're, as a family, completely and utterly on board with the peace process. But it's so just like 2001, you know, the new future, PSNI, New Hope. They badly, badly let us down. Badly let us down. Where do you go? You need a police force. We can't live in anarchy. I have children, I have grandchildren. You need a police force in case, you know, every society needs a police force. But this police force has let us down. And it needs to change. And the only way to change it, in my view, and I don't subscribe to any political party, I am a Republican, but only by peaceful means. I wouldn't kill for it, I wouldn't die for it, only by peaceful means. But, you know, we need to change the police force, we need to change it from, and I think the only way to change it is from the inside. Young, I hate labels, but young nationalists, young Republicans, young GAA, like a GAA squad, they've got degrees coming out of their backside. A lot of that young talent needs to go into the police force and change it from the inside for a police force for everybody. Like I think it was Craig said, a Protestant police force for Protestant people. Not in the 21st century. We need a police force for all the people. And the only way to do that is from the inside, I believe.
When did you first realise, Fintan, that Martin's murder wasn't being investigated the way it should have been?
When I first realised things weren't right, they had promised us the earth, moon, the stars, and knew who had done it. By this stage, we knew who had done it. We knew all the ins and outs. They knew all the ins and outs. But nothing was done. So, at that time, there was a department in the police called the Retrospective Murder Inquiry Team, which was looking at murders that happened after the Good Friday Agreement. The historical inquiry team, or historical inquiries, they were murders that happened before the Good Friday Agreement. The retrospective boys, they were after the Good Friday Agreement, which is where we fell in. And they brought a guy in from Scotland, brought a guy in from Wales, and all of a sudden, these guys started to make progress. These guys started to, I was the family liaison with them, and I knew then that we're getting somewhere. So I thought, well, why were we not getting somewhere when it was the local boys? Why were we running around chasing each other? We were getting promises, but they were chasing each other's tails and nothing was happening. So that's when I realised would need an outside force here to look at it, because there's too much of a hangover from the RUC in the PSNI at that time. And I'm not touring the whole PSNI. There's good guys in there. And as I keep saying, we need a police force and there's good people in there. But there is a force within. I come to the conclusion there's a force within the police or outside the police putting pressure on the police, which has an agenda from the old RUC. Could be Special Branch, could be MI5. I'm not a security expert, but there's some dark forces in there. And these guys come in, this guy, especially this big guy from Scotland, and he kicked it wide open. He kicked the gate open. And witness A, he came forward in 05-06 to the retrospective murders inquiry team. And he gave them, and he said in information, and he got in touch with the big Scotch fella, the big Scotch detective. And, you know, the thing about this, these guys were keeping us informed right along the way, and they were brilliant. And, you know, so, witness A came forward. He was part of the cleanup team after the murder, and he gave the police everything, blow by blow. This was in 05-06, blow by blow. So the big Scotch fellow, the big Scotch murder detective, he said, why are you only coming forward now? He says, what are you talking about? I come forward 2 days after the murder. So the big Glasgow guy, he went, done his job, and he seen it in writing. It was in writing that, yes, this guy had come forward 2 days after the murder, told him who it was, told him the mechanics of the whole thing, told him all about the cleanup, and nothing was done. So they knew 2 days after it, and they had a witness. They had a witness 2 days after it, and they done nothing. So then the Scotch guy, he verified everything that the guy was saying. He verified that it was in writing that he had come forward 2 days after. So he went, what's going on here? Are you protecting? He asked the question, the crucial question. Are you protecting people? Are you protecting agents here? And he never got an answer. But to him, it was obvious they were. So they arrested the culprits, the right people. They arrested them all.
How many people were arrested, Fenton? Can you remember?
You know, it started off with maybe six or seven, then they whittled it down.
Right.
But there was four people that were arrested, were charged. Now, one of the guys that was arrested, this is public knowledge, a fella called Hyde.
Neil Hyde, that's right.
Neil Hyde, he admitted it. He admitted everything, and he made statements incriminating the rest of them. So you had witness A told his story, Hyde told his story, which verified witness A's story. That's it wrapped up. That's it done. So I happened to be aware, it was my wedding anniversary or something, and I was away for a couple of days. The Scotch detective rang me in tears. I said, what's going on here? And he rang me and he was in tears and he said, they're taking me off the case. What? You've just made arrests? I know, and he was actually crying. They've took me off the case. He said, this stinks. This stinks. Don't let it go. It stinks. And I was dumbfounded. And so it was okay. His subordinate, he done the interviews. He oversaw the interviews. A couple weeks later, took him off the case.
Whose decision was this?
That's what I said. What's going on? They said it was logistics. And do you use the big Scotch fellas vocabulary? He says, logistics, my bollocks. It's because we're making progress. This is a policeman. This policeman's now a magistrate. This is not some hearsay idiot. Yeah? So, they took him off the case. They took the Welsh guy off the case who had overseen the interviews and who had torned Hyde. Now Hyde now became a witness.
He became an assistant offender. Yeah. From what I remember, I read the court case. He became an assisting offender, so he agreed to help.
Yeah.
He gave evidence. He admitted to handling the murder weapon used to murder Martin.
Yeah.
And what happened there then?
What happened there was he got a deal, something like 2 years, got a new identity. He got his sentence was going to be reduced to 2 years, no matter what it was. He got a new identity in England. He's living somewhere in England, witness protection. So then after they give him all that, they said he was no good as a witness and they couldn't proceed with the case. They had to drop the charges. Now you had witness A, told the whole story, told everything correct. Then you had Neil Hyde verifying everything that witness A had said. But excuse me, I should have told you they had dropped witness A because he had paid prior convictions. But anybody in this game or that game has prior convictions. They're not upstanding citizens. You know, if they're upstanding citizens, they wouldn't be involved with a drug dealing, murderous, bloodthirsty rabble. So they said he was no good a witness, and then they said Hyde was no good a witness, but they'd already give Hyde a reduced sentence to 2 years, 2 years for conspiracy to murder.
So Neil Hyde was convicted in relation to Martin's?
He was convicted, but got his sentence reduced, got a new identity, got a new life. Then they said he was an expression you used, but it basically meant he was no good as a witness. So you had two witnesses, both of them saying the same stuff. One was dropped because he had a record. This the new guy was dropped because then there was he had said that he was not in the LVF, but then they had a policewoman's evidence that she had been either recording or filming at his sworn in. So they were recording and filming this gang before Martin's murder, but the murder still went ahead. And
you're telling me, Fenton, sorry to interrupt, that the PSNI actually has footage of people being sworn into the LVF,
yeah,
people that could be charged with being members of a proscribed organisation. And yeah, they didn't use it to convict them of that, but used it to stop a conviction in the case of the murder of your brother.
Yeah. They used it as an excuse not to go ahead. Now, there's three odd guys were charged. Charged with lesser offences. Two guys called King brothers. Two brothers called with the surname of King. Another guy with the surname of Leckie. They had all been charged on the evidence from Hyde. Hyde got a reduction in a sentence. Hyde got a new identity. Then they're telling us that Hyde's evidence is no good and he's no good. But he already got all the rewards. So the charges were withdrawn.
And they all walked free.
They all walked free.
And Mr. Hyde's living under a new identity in England, carefree.
Carefree. And, you know, as I say, but we, you know, as Brian Kennedy says, that's not all. The guy, witness A, the guy who come forward 2 days after the murders, the guy who come forward again 5 years later, they said, no, he's no good. He's got a record, a CD record. But as I say, good people aren't involved in these things. So it says no, his evidence is no good. We can't use his evidence. Hyde had already corroborated his evidence, but they said, no, his evidence is no good. We can't use it there. Turns out he was a paid informer the whole time. And this just came to light in a spotlight program. The searchers in the spotlight program found out that the whole time this guy was a paid informer. They weren't paying him because his evidence was no good, because his information was no good. They were paying him because his information was good. But yet all the information he gave on my brother's murder was no good. But they'd been paying him the whole time for other information.
There's one word we haven't mentioned yet. And I mean, I don't even have to say it, because anybody listening to this podcast will have that word in their head already. Collusion.
Yeah. At the time, you know, after it, I come to the conclusion that there was collusion, but I thought it was collusion after the fact, because it was obvious that they were protecting these people. It was obvious that, you know, these people were agents and they were protecting them. So, but now when the soldier has come forward and his evidence hasn't been investigated, right, you know, prove to me that he's telling lies. But now I believe there was collusion before the fact and after the fact. You know, you've got 56,000 hours of.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The
recordings.
You've got recordings of Neil Hyde getting sworn in. You've got two obvious agents. So there was collusion before the fact and after the fact, and they're still protecting these people. And I said that the Welsh guy and the Scots guy, when they took them back across the water, another guy came in, but he was a local guy. And there's a police officer, a ranking police officer. And he started to manage myself and my brother's expectations down. But he has since retired. And I said to him, I met him after he retired. I had a good relationship with him. And I met him after he retired. And I says, why are they still protecting these people? And he said, do you see if you hear? He said, now these people are, at the time the cops told me that this guy, the main guy, the driver, was the biggest importer of drugs in the north of Ireland, maybe Ireland. Yeah? And the biggest importer of, at that time, was it meth?
Methamphetamine.
Or
amphetamines.
One of them things, and he was the biggest importer, and then went on to be a big importer of cocaine. But at the time, he was the biggest meth importer. And I said, well, why are they still protecting him? He said, you see, every time you hear of a big drugs burst, and especially in Mid-Ulster, that's him.
He's so providing the information.
He's still working for them. And he said, that's him.
Do you believe that your brother's life meant less to the police, the security forces, and MI5 than that of their informers?
Oh, God, it's just galling. It's galling. And do you know what? Do you know what gets me? The security forces made 40 years of mistakes. They made mistake after mistake, and you know, they made things worse in some cases, but they haven't learned their lesson. They're still making mistakes. They're still protecting the bad guys. You know, look at Steak Knife, 50 murders, and he was an agent. You know, so it's not just loyalists, it's all over. And they're still making the same mistakes over and over again, and they're still protecting these people. They're still protecting narco-terrorists. You know, like they call themselves loyalists. They're not loyalists. David Irvine was a loyalist, you know, and that's okay. That's a legitimate aspiration. But these guys are not loyal. These guys are just bloodthirsty rabble. So they are. It's sickening the way the whole thing has unfolded. As I say, back in Good Friday Agreement 2000, 2001, you know, there was such hope. And with a new police force, which we need a new police force, but they're just making the same mistakes. And that's crushing. That we're given so much hope and then the same thing's going on. You know, protecting, putting innocent people's lives below protecting their informants. And they've done that right through the whole Troubles. And they're still doing it. I'll give you a quick example. On the night Martin was murdered, he was in his local pub, Fa Joe's, him and the missus having a few pints, and he left. Now, there was a guy in the pub. We know his name. It's been verified. It's not hearsay. It's all been verified to the police. He made a phone call to tell these guys, to tell the murderers, Martin's left the pub. O'Hagan has left the pub. Now, that's proved. That's not hearsay. That's been proven by the police. He made the phone call. Called. They have the records. Called the phone. Tipped them off that Martin was leaving, then they murdered him. Nah, so we said, well, that's conspiracy to murder. Why is this guy not charged? So the police arrested this guy. I'm just, for legal reasons, I'm struggling not to say his name because I know his name. The police arrested this guy. And so then when the police asked him, you know, what was the crack here? You know, he says, I thought he was only going to get a kicking. So he was admitting, and they had the records, the phone records, and he was admitting that he had made the phone call, tipped them off, O'Hagan's left the pub, and he said, oh, I thought he was only going to get a kicking. He's never been charged. And, you know, our legal people have been saying, why is this man not charged? I thought he's only going to get a kicking. That's okay then.
It's really unbelievable.
Oh, flip. I'm like, that's not hearsay. That's the records. The phone records are there. The police have admitted that. The police have told us he thought he's only going to kick. And I let him off then. And they let him, and he still hasn't been charged.
How do you cope with this as a family? And I'm not talking about the loss of Martin. I'm talking about these blockades, this constant being let down, you know, being given hope, them having it taken away, and the hurt of knowing that the people who have admitted to murdering your brother or being part of that are just giving a Bible and going about your day. It's all right. Don't worry about it.
It's hard to live with. You know, the whole zeitgeist now is talking about men's mental health. This could ruin your mental health. You know, you have to sort of put it in a box and get on with your, you know, I have children, I have grandchildren. You have to get on with your life, but it's always there. It's always gnawing at you. And then when you look at, you know, when you look at the news, look at that young lady in Derry, Lyra McKee. Who are they protecting her? Like, the police would have knew the next day who pulled that trigger. He still not has him out in murder. You know, what's going on there? What's going on with the wee Noah Donoghue? What's going on there? You know, they're withholding information. So it's still going on. You know, have they not learned any lessons? Is it not a new police force? Is it... When they're still making the same mistakes over and over and over. It's sickening. It's corrupt. And it's sickening. And we need an outside police force to look at this. And it's got nothing to do with religion. It's got nothing to do with politics. It's got to do with bad policing.
For a journalist to be murdered, I mean, that sets a very dangerous precedent.
Yeah. Well, Martin was the first journalist to be murdered. Young Lyra McKee was the second journalist to be murdered. What's changed? Veronica Guerin was murdered in the Republic of Ireland. They changed the flipping laws. They changed the constitution. They went after them and they nailed them. What did they do here? Under the rug. Swept it away under the rug. You know, and every time I see that Lyra McKee's name coming up in the news, it breaks my heart because they're doing the same thing there as what they did in Moira Martin.
Punity.
They're protecting the people that done it, or the person that done it. You know, they're putting the cart before the horse. They're protecting the bad guys, and it's the good guys that's suffering.
Absolutely.
And, you know, have they learnt nothing from all them years, you know, of their games? Sometimes it seems to me that over the, you know, from over the Troubles, it was the first murder, 66, and then it just escalated and escalated. Sometimes it seems to me that the securocrats used the north of Ireland as like a, for war gaming. You know, they used it like a sphere to do their wee war games and play out their wee intelligence scenarios. And to a lesser extent, they're still doing it. Wargaming in our home.
What damage do you think Martin's murder has done on the freedom of the press in Northern Ireland?
Oh, yeah. I'll give an example. I'll give you two examples. There was an interview done by the Sunday World in Dublin on R. Martin on his anniversary, around about his anniversary, 20th anniversary. And the guy, it was an erstwhile colleague of Martin's who they interviewed. And I was listening to it and I just couldn't believe it. They never once mentioned the elephant in the room, the fact that, you know, it's glaringly obvious that there was collusion here. There was collusion before the fact, after the fact. Done the whole interview and this guy never mentioned it once. He talked a whole big load of nonsense. The same young lady interviewed another Sunday World guy about the murder or the death of Johnny Adair's sidekick, Skelly. And part of the interview, he said, these were two extraordinary people. He was lionizing them. These two murdering psychopaths. And he was lionizing them. Why? Was he playing to that audience? Was he afraid? Maybe the journalists are now afraid to tell the truth because they don't want to end up like Ann Martin.
I mean, there's not a year that goes past that we don't hear about journalists being threatened in Northern Ireland. And yes, the threats come from both sides, but the majority of them have come from loyalist paramilitaries. I mean, has Martin's death emboldened, you know, certain paramilitaries to make those threats, do you think? Or
Yeah. It worked. They got away with it. So if you do something and you get away with it, you're going to do it again. If you do something and you get nailed for it and you get life imprisonment, you're not going to do it again. But if you get away with it, you're going to keep doing it. And I suppose it's in a roundabout way, it's the state controlling the media through fear.
Well, we go back to, I mean, Martin's childhood, growing up, he was the oldest member of the family and throughout his life, and go through how he got into journalism.
Well, Martin was always a bit of he was always radical, and he was always, he'd have seen himself in the late 60s, you know, obviously you had civil rights, what was happening in America with Martin Luther King and the Kennedys and stuff, and he was a child of that era. And he was a revolutionary. He considered himself a Marxist. He was a Marxist. And he went away to Dublin to work and live. And he got involved with people in Dublin was before the split in the IRA. And then when the split happened, he didn't go with Provost. But it was more...
So Martin joined the IRA and he became a member of the official IRA.
Yeah, no, he actually would have been a member... To my knowledge, he was just a wee lad. I was just a kid, but... He would have been a member of the IRA, then the split happened with the Provost, and he stayed with the official IRA. But I don't even know at that stage if he was actually a member. I think he was just, you know, running with that crowd, and he was a revolutionary, but he wouldn't have been...
involved in violence?
Well, he wouldn't have been as hard-line in that way, I don't believe, but... Then, when internment happened, a whole lot of doors that kicked our door in, and like my dad at the time had his own business, and we were living in a mixed area, and they come in and they racked our house, and I was only about 9 or 10, and they racked our house, and they didn't get Martin, but they got him a few weeks later, in Kewilkie, and they interned him, and. That probably radicalised them. That's the buzzword now. That's, you know, our Muslim friends, that the radicalisation, and that radicalised them in Loncashire, and he was interned.
How long was he interned for?
Oh God, over a year anyway. I can't remember exactly, but well over a year. And I suppose that cemented his official IRA credentials. And then he got out, and he was arrested then with he was moving weapons, and he was arrested, and he got 7 years. And in the meantime, he'd got married. He married a Protestant girl, and then he got out from being interned, and there was my sister's best friend was murdered in a bomb, Provo bomb, and I think that sickened all of us, but I think that sickened Martin. He's seen the futility of violence, and he's seen what a bomb does to somebody, and that was him finished.
That was the murder of Philomena Green?
It was, and which was just 16-year-old, lovely, lovely girl. She was in Nervihus all the time with my sister Joanne, and it was awful. And
what was the circumstances of that, Fintan, for anybody listening who wasn't aware of Philomena's murder?
My sister and Philomena and another girl, Nuala, they were out for the night, and my dad didn't live with us, and he had his own wee house, but he had mental health issues, and he was in the hospital. So when my sister seen the light on in his house, she thought, oh, my dad must be out of hospital. So they called in, opened the door, bang. Philomena was killed right away. And
professional IRA had planted a bomb at your father's house.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, from probably my whole family, that was seeing, you know, this is not right. You know, that, you know, this is not the way to do things. You know, and as I say, I am a Republican, but I think it's a mistake. I think the violence was a mistake. I think there's a better way of doing it. And, you know, even for bringing good working class Protestants along with us, you're not going to bring them along with us if you're planting bombs and shooting. So I believe to bring the whole working class along with us, the peaceful way, the civil rights way, was a better way of doing it.
So as you said, you believe that the murder of Philomena by the IRA could have been a turning point for Martin?
That was suggested to me by a journalist, and at the time when he suggested it to me, BBC journalist suggested to me, and I said, I don't know. But then I thought about it, and I said, Jesus, that could be right. Because it was such a shock, you know, and God love Philomena's mommy and daddy. His daddy's passed now, and the whole family, it just wrecked that whole family, and it had a devastating effect on our family, because my sister was my dad's house, and it was my sister was with her, and Nuala Bourke, and it was just.
And why would the provisional IRA target your father's house?
Well, they said while my dad was in hospital, they said that the Brits were using the house, which was nonsense. But I think it turned our whole family against using, that showed us the futility of violence. Like, what changed? Nothing changed. It didn't bring us any closer to a republic, or a socialist republic. Didn't bring us any closer to that. And I think it had a devastating effect on the whole family, but I think that was the last nail in the coffin of Martin's novel analogy there. But that was Martin finished with the political violence and our support for political violence, because there's no evidence to say he was ever involved in political violence. But that was the end of that. And even as I say, you'd married in Lurgan, we say the oil end of town, which means you're a Protestant, and this end of town means you're a Catholic. But I, Martin, wasn't a Catholic. He had no time for religion. He hated religion, and he hated bigots even more, which is ironic that bigots would end up killing him. But so I, Martin, married a girl from the end of town, had in the end three youngsters, and his three youngsters he sent integrated education. Now in the 70s, like, I remember being me and him in a pub in the 70s, and whatever way the conversation was going, one of the boys in the pub, was a big gang of us all sitting drinking, and one of the guys says, what school do your youngsters go to? Ryan Martin said, he named Brownlow, he named the school. What sort of schools? I said, it's integrated education. And everybody was going, well, what's that? But yet, no, he was adamant. I'm sending my children integrated education, and I do believe that's the only way forward too. Like, you know, if you went go to school with somebody, you're less likely to be throwing petrol bombs at them. And I believe in integrated education too. But so he was groundbreaking. He was, one of the first person I knew to send his kids to an integrated school. And he had no time whatsoever for religion. He hated bigots. He was, you know, when the peace process, then he went back to school, got his degree, back to Queens, I think it was, or Jordanstown, I can't remember. But he got his degree anyway, and then he wingled his way into journalism. He got a job in Fortnite magazine. He's getting about £90 a week. But that was him. He got his NUJ card then. He was just elated, over the moon. Then he got a job in the Sunday World, and, you know, he'd done a bit of work for the BBC. He'd done a bit of work for the Irish News. But then he got a job in the BBC, or sorry, in the full-time job in the Sunday World, and that was him. He was the proverbial, what's that expression?
He was just a Rottweiler, basically. He was going after everybody, no matter what paramilitary group it was, who you were. It was about crime and corruption and everything else. And there was no, you would say there was no bias there.
He didn't care where it was coming from. He didn't care if it was coming from a Republican source, coming from the Loyalist source. He went after them. And, you know, he was courageous, but courageous to the point of foolhardy, because he just wouldn't let go.
He was abducted by the IRA over one of his stories.
They found Martin's name in a policeman's notebook, a detective's notebook. Martin's name was in it. Because he was one of Martin's contacts a journalist, you have to talk to the police. Journalist, you talk to the police, you talk to the provost, you talk to the loyalists, you talk to anybody, you're going to get a story. And so the provost seen his name, so the provost says, "Will you come and meet us?" And in South Armagh, he met them, and they put a hood over his head, put him in the back of a car, and took him away and questioned him. And the time they finished, they satisfied themselves that this guy is not a tout, this guy's a journalist. And at the time they satisfied themselves that Martin wasn't, he was a journalist, they shook hands with him and says, sorry about this. Shook hands with him and says, "Listen, good man, we know now."
Well, what gave them the right, or for them to think they had the power to do that? Martin was a journalist for a start. He was no longer a member of the IRA. Was it because he came from a nationalist background, or what was that about? I mean,
the way the provost looked at it, there was a war going on and they had to do what they had to do. I didn't agree with I didn't agree with the violence, but I can understand it from their point of view.
But a scary experience. Did he ever talk about it to you? Was he not scared?
He did talk about it, but it didn't seem to really... It did faze him. Like, people take you away in the back of a car and
with a hood over your head.
And they have, you know, they have, it's their yes or no that you live or die, you know. But they interrogated them and they satisfied themselves that they were barking up the wrong tree. He was just a journalist, and he was doing his job, and they let him go, and he didn't seem... He wasn't emotionally traumatized or anything. He was just part of the job.
Part of the job.
And then shortly after that, their Billy Wright's crew come after him, and the Sunday World moved him to Cork. And I wish to God he'd have stayed in Cork. But he was there on his own, and he missed his family and he missed his home, and he come back.
And what year was that? Can you remember, Fenton? Or how long before?
It was in the 90s.
He moved to Cork, and he was in the Sun, because the Sunday World would have had an office in Cork at that time.
Yeah.
And he stayed down there. Did he continue writing about paramilitaries when he was down there, or did they take him off that patch completely? You're not sure, probably?
I'm not sure.
Was there ever any negotiations or anything done, any mediators to... ensure his safety?
The guys on the street is, I don't know, but I'm not sure. I don't know. He come back. I don't know if he got assurances or not, but he did come back and he got stuck right in again. He just picked up where he left off.
And so he, no matter what threats were issued to him, he just got back to it. There was no...
The Billy Wright thing affected him more than the Provo thing, I think. And like, I remember I used to live around the corner from him, and he called in. I'm not sure if this was before he went or when he came back, but he called in to see me anyway, and me and him sat at our kitchen table and drank a bottle of whiskey. And, you know, like, Billy Wright, also an agent, also murder him with impunity. If this fella's after you, if his crew's after you, they're not, as the journalist from the Sunday World said about thing, they're not extraordinary, they're not superhuman. They're just psychopathic killers, and they're after you, and they have the infrastructure to kill you. They have the immunity to kill you. They have the helping of the security forces to kill you. You're scared.
And you're living right in his heartland.
So he was, apparently he had been seen in outside Martin's house too, you know. And so, yeah, of course, that shook him. That shook him, and it shook us. And we were saying, for Christ's sake, Martin, stay in Cork. And God love my ma. My ma was, oh, did you see our Martin story in the paper? And it was near as if she had a premonition. And yeah, he should have stayed in Cork.
So the threats continued, and probably by the, you know, sadly, as a journalist, you sometimes get a wee bit too complacent because you're continually getting threats, and maybe sometimes you have to move house. Martin was getting those threats. Do you ever believe that he actually believed he'd be murdered?
I think he said, you know, after the Good Friday Agreement, he said his mantra was the war's over, and he moved where he moved to because, according to him, the war was over. And there was a real good feeling of, you know, there was a real hope, and there was a real, you know, Clinton was here, John Hume, Tony Blair, Gerry Adams, they were all, David Trimble, they were all doing their bit, and they were all pulling us in the right direction, and there was a real hope. And Martin thought, I can live, you know, you should be able to live where you want, you should be able to, you know, you shouldn't fear for your life moving to a certain area. And he foolishly thought, I'll move up here. And he made it easy for him.
Billy Wright had been dead 4 years by that stage. Did that take, you know, relief?
Probably.
Because it was Billy Wright who seemed to have a real issue with Martin and his reporting.
Well, Martin sort of, he coined the phrase keen rat. And
he didn't like that nickname.
No. And he seemed to have, you know, his heart was set on getting rid of Martin.
Is it true that he said, if anything happens to me, it should happen to Martin O'Hagan tenfold? Is that true? Is there any truth to that?
I don't know. I've heard it. I don't know. But, you know, then when he was killed, anybody who pays attention to what's happening here and has paid attention, it was obvious that it was his handlers let him be killed. And he knew too much. All the bodies were buried. He knew too much, so they killed him, or they allowed him to be killed. Same thing. So when he was dead, I think it was a relief. And then, but, you know, Billy's minions were still, you know, murderous psychopaths. And then when Martin moved up there, they thought all their Christmases had come at once. They thought, you know, they couldn't believe their luck from their point of view. And they killed him.
Martin had been working on stories surrounding collusion at that time. Are you aware of what that involved?
Well, apparently he was working on a few different things. Now, don't get me wrong, some of the stories are Martin done when he was trying to climb up the greasy pole of journalism were awful. And he would have admitted himself that they were awful, you know, but he had made contacts within loyalism, and he was getting better at what he was doing. And apparently he was looking at a few different things. But we'll never know because the police took all that away and we haven't seen it since.
Yes, Martin's journalism material was seized by police and it was never returned to you or his family.
To the best of my knowledge, I can't speak for his late wife and children, but to the best of my knowledge, it's disappeared.
Could you sum him up as a brother and as a human being?
He was controversial. He was game. He was too game for his own good. He was too brave for his own good. Courageous to the point of foolhardy. Brilliant bit of crack. Very funny. Killed himself laughing at his own jokes. Never had a rap. He was earning good money, but he never had a rap. he would have, as I say, he was controversial, he was fiery. He would have fell out with you, and his MO to get out of a pub was he'd have picked an argument and stormed out. At times, 4 weeks later, you'd have been standing in a pub and he'd put behind you, "That's a pint of our kid." You know, he's just, he couldn't help but love him. But he was no angel. He was controversial, and he rubbed people up the wrong way, and he didn't care. He was doing his job, and he was just he loved it. He loved being a journalist, and he just, you know, everybody let him down. That, you know, we have asked, with myself and my brothers, Woken Men, we have a reward. We've still a reward for 50 grand, which, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a whole, it mightn't be a fortune, but it's a fortune to us. We're working men. Well, I'm semi-retired now, so I'm half a working man. But, we've asked the Sunday World Dad that offer, Dad that reward. They're making stupid excuses not to do it. We've asked the NUJ Dad that reward, making stupid excuses, won't do it. So they've all sort of let them down. The police has let them down. By not nailing the killers, the is industry, that's the right way to describe it, have let them down. You know, when you look in the Republic of Ireland, what they've done for Veronica Guerin, you know, Maggie Thatcher famously or infamously said that, where was it, was as British as Finchley? You know, South Armagh is as British as Finchley, something like stupid like that there. If they'd killed a journalist out of the Times, would have got the same treatment? If they'd killed a journalist out of the BBC, would have got the BBC in England? Would have got the same treatment? You know, so it's they just let that they let us Martin's family down, they let his wife and children down, his erstwhile employers haven't put their money where their mouth is, his union. He was a union man. He was the NUJ representative or whatever the way is described. They have let him down. You know, if they haven't let him down, add their reward. If four woken men can scrape the guy 50 grand for a reward, surely to God they can throw in a few thousand. Surely to God the Sunday World can throw in a few thousand. You know, put your money where your mouth is, boys.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.